getting late back home after the gigs and couldn't get up for school, and I had to make the choice. And a big showdown with the head of Wimbledon Art School. He swore that I'd be back there within a few weeks, but I never did go back.
A lot of musicians from that era, the early 60s, either went to art school or did something in that field, and they also wanted to go into a blues band. Why was that?
I don't know. I suppose the blues came from trad jazz, which was quite popular in the art school, and it was a sort of a rebellion against the trad jazz types. They wanted to find something else that was, you know, hip, and, you know, carry an album of John Lee Hooker instead of Miles Davis or Humphrey Lyttelton. And that's, you could see these cliques sort of forming in the art schools. And it is curious, though, that a lot of blues bands and guitarists especially have come from art school background.
Who were some of the people that influenced you, that you admired, that were professionals at that time? They weren't actually at school, they were out there playing, earning money.
My influences, it was a sort of chaotic jumble of 50s style rock. All sorts of things were happening. I mean, I never got Elvis Presley out of my system, really. I mean, the guitarist, Scotty Moore, from those records, that was really what knocked me over, and the early Little Richard records. And so, you're talking about 57, 58 to about 61, with that still going on in my mind, anyway.
And it takes a hell of... influenced by American players.
Oh, yes, always American. I used to stick glued to the radio, listening to Luxembourg, and... because that was the only place they'd play a rock and roll record for a while.
Well, I mean, white blues hadn't happened, really, and certainly hadn't happened in Britain at that point. So what you were doing was very much experimental, and people like Alexis Corner and Cyril Davis.
Yeah, it was just a genuine love for Negro blues and black and white rock and roll. And I didn't really see the line. I just loved music, period. I didn't care whether black or white or what. And then you start learning these things. And you find out that you narrow the field down to about two or three guitarists, and it goes on, you know. And, you know, when you're sort of 16 or 17, you keep going out in the streets and meeting all your friends, and you say, that's not happening anymore, this is the guy you listen to. Mm-hmm. And it was very healthy, very fertile period.
Guitars are things that, in your case, lead guitar or a bass guitarist would admire, particular types of guitars, played by particular types of musicians as well. Was there any instrument that yours had an inkling to buy at some point?
Well, my mother was desperate for me to learn the piano, which I didn't want to learn. I just liked listening to. It was, you know, I mean, there's a lot of difference between actually playing an instrument and listening to somebody playing. And I couldn't get along with the piano. And I just always felt that it was such a popular instrument. Everybody was playing it. And there was the average kid of 12 on our block could play Brahms and Liszt and all that sort of stuff. And I just didn't have the feel for that. But as soon as I picked up a violin and plunked around with it without the bow, I knew there was something there, and a cello. Anything that you could make an unusual sound with, and it was unusual, I can tell you. And sort of bashing it with rulers and slapping it, and that was more me. I had rock and roll in the blood, you know, from that point of view.
What sort of exercises, guitar exercises, did you practice when you started? Nowadays...
I used to ape off people like Buddy Holly, because he was a wizard guitarist. And there was a little phrase he played at the beginning of one of his records, "That'll Be the Day," that I learnt. It was a honky-tonk piano lick, but it sounded better on guitar. So I learnt that and impressed all my friends, and they said, "Hey, Beck can play the guitar." You know, I couldn't really. I could just play that and then say, "Well, I'm not playing anymore. That's it." and then I have to go home and sweat and learn a bit more. That's how it started.
What about your contemporaries, people that were also practicing and playing in the early days too? Did you keep an eye on them and see what they were up to?
Not too much. I had very slanted views on. I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and I didn't think anybody could play the drums properly. They all seemed to lack the rock feel that was so right and so eminent in all those early rock records of the 50s, of American 50s records. So I couldn't stand most English bands at that time. Then you start hearing these names and you keep having them crammed down your throat. And once in a while you'd go out within sort of bus journey and see somebody playing in a village hall or town hall somewhere. And you'd come away completely blown away, not so much with the musicianship, but the fact that there they were on stage and doing what you really wanted to do. I think Lord Sutch and the Savages and things like that. Outrageous. And so then I had a whole more things to think about, you know, stage presence, and would I be able to play once I got on stage, you know, could I entertain with the sort of music that I was interested in.
So once you left art school, that the object in mind was to just go pro, was it?
I just loved the feeling of being on stage. It was terrifying, but it was over in a flash. And I'd sort of be going home to where I lived in Wallington from Tunbridge on a Wednesday night, wondering what the hell happened to the evening. It was just over in a flash. And you just, the next morning, you felt great that people were dancing and screaming and clapping. And even those days, you know.
Who were the people that you played with before you joined the Yardbirds?
Oh, there were several little... I mean, bands were... It was phenomenal if a band stayed together with the same lineup for a week in those days. We'd have to pick up different drummers because it'd be nothing for us to pick up the drummer. He'd have a row with his girlfriend and then we'd have to pick up another drummer on the way to the gig because stuff like that. So I played with a few local bands and found that they weren't really... Usually the drummer and the bass player were useless music.
So that took you through the early 60s until you joined the Yardbirds. How did you actually meet up with the band?
I was doing quite well with a band called the Tridents. I mean, that's mentioned several times in little books I've written and, you know, articles I've written in magazines. And people have come to know the Tridents almost, but there's not any recorded works apart from one demo tape that I've got in my shelf there somewhere.
Not letting you
and,
know.
we played the 100 Club and we were really following the steps of the Yardbirds and the Who weren't there. They were called the High Numbers. The Stones and Yardbirds were the names that were constantly bandied around.
The Blues Breakers were there too, weren't they? The Blues Breakers, John Mayall.
I didn't hear too much about them until I started going to a guitar shop and trying to do miracle deals with swapping guitars. And then they say, where are you going tonight? You've got to go and see John Mayall. I went, oh, where's he playing? And it was too far north of London. I didn't know my way around. And I thought, no, I'll get the train home. So I was terrible. I had to go home all the time. You know, hated going. I was like Jim Page. Couldn't stand being on the road.
So you and the Tridents followed the Yardbirds around.
That's right. And one marvellous night in the 100 Club, this hand came out and grabbed me and said, you will be a star, you know.
Whose hand was that?
It was Hamish Grimes and George Yogomelski. They were the Yardbirds spokesman and manager. And they said, I thought it was going to be beaten up. Because Giorgio looks a bit like... Fidel Castro, you know. I thought, this is it, I'm going to be done over. What have I done?
I should never have come.
And they put me up,
City.
And they, I think it was a non-alcohol bar, right, and they slapped this plastic beaker of orange juice down and said, right, sit down here, we're going to talk to you. And they told me I had a chance to be in a top band and if I was interested to be at 18 Carlisle Street, I can remember the name of the address, at 10 o'clock the next morning or the next day, I think. And I was there. And then I found out it was the Yardbirds. I was very cross because I'd been bad-mouthing the Yardbirds, only flying the flag for the Tridents because we were better than the Yardbirds. So I had to suddenly jump off one boat onto another and say, well, sorry, lads, the Tridents weren't really quite making it. Mm. Plus, they had a nice suit, the Yardbirds, for me, so that swung.
Did the guys in the Tridents go on to bigger and better things after that, or did they just disappear?
I'm afraid not. No, they didn't really have much... going in terms of a front man. They had three brothers and they all seemed to melt together into this non-existent sort of folk blues type of thing. I mean, they were very shy. One would sort of sing facing the back of the stage and the other one would wander about. Mm. And I used to be quite popular because I used to run around a bit and make a few noises and a few funny faces. And when I left, they couldn't find another guitarist. So they fizzled out.
Had you actually seen the Yardbirds play?
No, I just kept hearing about it. I'd never even seen them, even to the time when I joined. I hadn't seen them play.
So you didn't know them?
No. We've skipped a little bit where Jim Page came into the picture. He said, have you ever heard the Yardbirds? And I said, no. And he played me 5 long years off the 5 Live Yardbirds album, and I just fell over. I couldn't believe it. It was so much what I wanted to do. I think that was the time when I became aware of them. And then lo and behold, a few weeks later, I'm being asked to join. And it was all because of Jim Page.
Well, Jim didn't really want to play in the band in those days because he was quite a busy session musician at that point, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think he thought that his father was an advisor to him. He said, son, don't do this, don't do that. You'll just be in that band and you'll lose your contacts with the session world. Somebody will step in and you'll be out, you know, struggling again. Mm. You know, it's understandable. You know, session was a really sort of well-respected job, and especially a rock guitarist being... Mm. you know, the first person that wants a rock guitarist to ring him up, you know. Mm. He and Jim Sullivan were the two faces in rock guitar at that time.
What were your impressions of people like Eric Clapton in those days?
Well, the first time I heard him was on that Five Live Yardbirds album that Jim played me, and I was so thrilled with it. And I just thought, well, how the hell can I keep up with this, you know? Because I'd only just made up my mind that blues was for me, and not so much this pop rock that was Beatlesified, you know. I couldn't stand that stuff. Mm. Freddie and the Dreamers and all that junk.
So in some ways, when you were offered this rather smart Italian black suit, you must have been a bit...
Camel colour.
Worried about it. Yeah.
I was terrified. They had my hair off, and it was really serious. The first day I signed with them, they had me around some dreadful Italian hairdresser, and off came the hair, and I felt like a thug. It was crew cut and terrible. They wanted me to look like Eric, even if I didn't play like it. And I felt, actually, after about a week, I felt a whole lot better for having it off. But.
Well, you joined the band just as one of the first singles that made it for them, For Your Love, was released.
It was too easy. I felt a bit of a cheat, really, because the record was it had hit written all over it, and Eric knew that, and the whole business was buzzing about this record, and that was part of the reason why Eric left, because he could see the Yardbirds heading in a very commercial direction, and he was heavily into blues at that time, and he could see that he was on a loser, really, from that point. He had to get playing blues, otherwise he might be on television singing For Your Love, and he didn't want that.
But you did play with him on stage, didn't you?
No, never.
Never. So, I mean, you actually replaced him.
That's right, yeah. We had about a week's rehearsal every day at the Marquee. And then that was pretty easy too, because we left the gear set up at the rehearsal and played in the evening. So I felt right at home. Mm-hmm. Played Beck's Boogie and got a standing ovation, and that was the end of it.
Mm. Well, of course, he went on to John Mayall and the Blues Breakers, and really, yeah, as you say, confirmed his idea of doing blues.
Yes, that's right.
So it was sometime after?
Yeah, I don't think it happened till... Oh, maybe 6 months after. That was a long time in the span of a lot of pop band.
What do you think of For Your Love as a song? It was written by Graham Gouldman, who was, the old Mindbenders originally, wasn't
it? I quite liked it. It could have been a whole lot worse, you know. I mean, when they said, you know, we're going to make a pop record, I went, oh, dear, I just couldn't handle all that. But then when I heard it, it seemed a bit bizarre. I had to get used to the idea that I was playing 12-string, in place of the harpsichord, which was on the introduction of the record. So it all felt really strange, you know, trying to emulate the sound of a harpsichord on a 12-string. Mm. But it was more what I was after, you know, creating different sounds on the guitar.
A bit later in the summer, you released another single, which was when you were properly in the band, called Heartful of Soul.
Yeah. That's right. Well, we had Heartful of Soul cut almost immediately. I joined the band. In fact, I think it was cut before the release of For Your Love. I couldn't understand what was going on. I was every day I was doing something different with them. And I remember Bill Relf, Keith Relf's father, coming in beaming all over his face, which never happened. And he said, it's in the charts. And I was delighted in one way, because the band was going to be lifted off the ground, but I wasn't on the record. So I felt, I have to explain this away, chaps.
Because in those days, if you released a hit single, you had to follow it up pretty quickly, because the charts changed so quickly, didn't they?
Not quite as quickly as they do now, I don't think. Mm.
What was it like to play in the Yardbirds in the first 6 months? Did you do lots of gigs, lots of appearances?
I was like the most incredible schoolboy trip of all time. I mean, you stay in hotels and you had no mum and dad breathing down your neck. It was terrific. No, I didn't want to go home. Once I got the taste of it, staying on these big Midland hotels, and I loved it. Mm.
You hadn't toured America at that point, had you? No.
That was coming. We knew that was in the breeze, but Giorgio did a reconnoitering of the States. He went over there just to check it out and came back with T-shirts and this, that and the other, and contracts and stuff. We knew that we'd probably be going later on that year, 1965.
Mm. Something that happened to the Yardbirds songs halfway through 65, when you released Heartful of Soul, was you released Evil Hearted You and Still I'm Sad, which was a double A side.
That's right.
And there were psychedelic songs in a way, weren't they? Very much like a lot of the other pop singles.
Yes, a lot of that was... it started to gel, all the creativity started to gel in quite an exciting way. Mm. I mean, a Gregorian chant. Mm. But I think that's where they fell down a bit, because once they'd done a record like that, which was a really good record, how do you top a Gregorian chant, you know? Mm. I mean, you have to be that much different again. And there just wasn't it wasn't possible to be that much different on demand, you know.
Mm. Eric Clapton left the Yardbirds because of that direction musically. I mean, he didn't like the poppy singles, did he?
But that was the weird thing, because we weren't trying to be poppy. Mm. We were trying to do different styles of... Mm. Just anything and everything, Indian and flavour and Gregorian chants, which probably annoyed Eric, I should imagine, because he probably thought we were going to do Dave Clark Five Star and Rolling Stones type stuff.
But you felt quite comfortable about it yourself.
Oh, yeah, because I was actively involved in the construction of the records.
Mm-hmm. Then Shapes of Things came out, which was end of 65, wasn't it?
Bit in there. Mm. You know, I had the Indian Raga solo in the middle with a sort of a sitar-style guitar. Mm. Mm.
Some of the songs that that you did, like you said, Beck's Boogie, which was one of the old chestnuts, really, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it was a complete showcase of all the flashy licks that I'd learned, and it was great, because there was no messing with it, you know. You could just get... If Jim, the drummer and the bass player, had fallen asleep, I could have carried on playing, because it's self-accompanied. There's a rhythm pattern and then a solo pattern and a rhythm pattern. In fact, it would have been more impressive without the band, really.
It was almost standard practice in those days as well for the guitarist to have a lead break, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You'd do a 3-minute encore piece on your own, and the band, as you say, could literally go to sleep if they wanted to.
Yes, but it was a bit worrying, because we were still 12-bar then, you know. It was really strange, because a lot of the repertoire was 12-bar blues. Then there'd be a thing like For Your Love, which was nothing like a 12-bar, you know, then Heartful of Soul, and they weren't really the standard Chicago 12-bar blues. Mm. Mm. And so people didn't really know what the hell we were all about, really.
You mentioned that you were in hotels and travelling around a lot. Had you, at that point, moved into London, or were you still living in the south of England?
I was living at home with my mum and dad, and just, you know, it was just a sort of small house in Wallington, suburbia, yeah.
Swept along a lot by the stardom and success of the Yardbirds.
Well, I mean, your mum and dad think that you're a loser and a waster and all the rest of it, not getting a proper job, and then they see you on TV and they think you're the most wonderful thing ever walked.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I say, in early 66, Shapes of Things came out, which perhaps one of the most successful songs that you released.
That's when America came in the picture. We'd gone there and they did... For Your Love was quite big, because that was obvious. I mean, that could be an international hit. But Shapes of Things was a little bit, you know, non-teeny bop.
A bit downbeat, wasn't it?
Yeah. A bit sort of heavy lyrics as well, you know, double, you know, whatever meanings.
What was the US tour like? First time for the Yardbirds?
Oh, amazing. Absolutely.
You've never
amazing.
Been there before, have you?
No, it was all too quick for me. I couldn't, you know, I wanted to go there on a holiday to see what I was looking at. But that was out of the window. We couldn't do that. We had to just take in the place as we were touring. Mm.
How was that tour organised? Did you have any problems?
Very bad, very bad. It was probably not much different to the 50s style rock tours, because there was no big promoter, so to speak. And, I mean, there was no road managers, no hardly any. We'd carry the gear ourselves, you know. One roadie would do all the gear.
Of course, these days, an American tour is a very organised affair. Yeah. Groups don't go over unless they know they're going to do a certain amount of cities and a certain size of audience.
The Yardbirds were pioneers in that sense. Very much so. I mean,
you were really the beginning of the British invasion.
Yeah.
Of the 60s.
Of experimental psychedelic sort of music.
Do you remember any experiences that you had, perhaps in the West Coast, for example?
Where we got asked to play at a party because they knew we weren't going to play the proper gig. Yeah, it was great.
Why was that? Why weren't you allowed to play the gig?
There was a lot of red tape. You had to have a visa and a pass and all sorts of. Blood sample and a piece of skin from the back of the head. No, it was pretty heavy trying to get clearance on each of these dates. And Giorgio said, I'm afraid there's nothing for it. We've got to organise a little party somewhere. And we met this character called Kim Fowley, who's an infamous party organiser. And that was one of the best things I can ever remember doing, because people didn't have to pay money. And it was just music and fun and people. It was just great.
Of course, we called our underground scene after people like the Pink Floyd, but that was much later, really. That was the end of the 60s, and yet you were doing something that was very underground, going and playing.
It was so underground, nobody heard of it.
What was the reaction to Americans? Because here you were, white man's blues in some ways, and yet they'd had a tradition of black Chicago blues people like Muddy Waters for years.
But you'd get these sort of chewing gum type girls jumping up and down because of the image. But the irony of it is that they were listening to their own music, you know, their own sort of culture. Mm. And then we came to Chicago, and that's when we found out what was going on, you know, because there was a Chicago blues club there, and we found we were playing on the same stage as Muddy Waters had been playing, and that's what we really wanted. Mm. But we, outside the boundary of Chicago, it wasn't really accepted. Mm. You know, you get these sort of students coming up and say, yeah, man, you're into Otis Rush, Otis. And we were getting accepted by the blues fanatics over there, which is great.
Also, equally, what must have been strange for Americans seeing you come over was that they'd had the whole Liverpool scene just before you.
Oh, yeah,
Only a couple of years beforehand.
Do you guys know the Beatles? You know, and we said, no.
And not
really.
Just the Beatles, there was Freddie and the Dreamers, Jerry and the Pacemakers, the Merseybeats, the whole Cilla Black. I mean, they were all doing almost review tours. There'd be five or six...
Package tours.
Right. And you actually did some of those sorts of tours, didn't you?
I did half of one. The Dick Clark package tour. And if I ever see Dick Clark, I'm going to punch him right on the nose. He put us in this stinking old coach. And they'd never told us we'd be doing 600-mile drives and then playing in a terrible gig. I mean, there were dreadful conditions.
And you literally only had, 25, 30 minutes sometimes?
Yeah.
And if it took you too long to set up, you
lost your two numbers or whatever it was. Mm, mm.
But you must have learnt a lot then. I mean, you must have learnt to be much more efficient at getting those numbers organised and going from one number to the other without too much setting
That's
up.
That's right. We were very annoyed that we couldn't get settled. I mean, just as soon as you get your first bead of sweat, you're off. Mm. And you're thinking, wow. And then on goes Johnny Tillotson or somebody. I mean, it was really awful, those short package tours. Mm. We were just waiting for the day when we could play a full 40-minute set or hour set. Which we did later on.
When did that happen? Was that some years later, or was that just the next time you went?
It was LA which took us under their wing. You know, the KRLA radio started playing tapes that weren't released. I mean, people started making bootlegs on the radio and stuff, of rare tapes. And we began to cause this real stir, you know, without any press. And that's what we played on, no press. And you just got to go and see these guys, you know. And we played the Hollywood Palladium. And it was packed for three nights, solid, standing room only. We just knew that something was going on there. Mm. And then the Dick Clark tour came after that. And I left. I just couldn't handle the strain of it. Mm.
Looking on from the time the Yardbirds went out and in a way pioneered the concert circuit for British bands, or European bands in general. Now, a group like Cream went out there, and they were big from the very first day, weren't they? They
very
did Madison Square Garden.
It was very astute planning. I think whoever was handling them knew exactly the zones, you know, to stick
the pin.
You were
almost guinea pigs then, weren't you?
You'd
taught the industry a lesson about how to organise tours.
Yeah, absolutely. And because of certain press that leaked out about Eric Clapton, they wanted to know who was on what record. You know, was Jeff playing on For Your Love Note? Well, who was on the Heartless Heart? It was Jeff. Oh, so this started this great thing. So Eric was another face they all wanted to see. And whoever set up that promo tour, I mean, was genius. Because, like you say, they didn't have any messing about. Straight in the Whiskey a Go-Go, and they were there doing encores for the whole night. Mm-hmm. And then asked back at double the money, and then Chicago. Then they did a tour with The Who, which really broke the cream then. Mm.
You say that people always inquired as to who the guitarist was on each of the tracks, or specific tracks of the others. There's always been this interest in the Yardbirds, and that's why this interview's taking place today. Mm. Years later, although the band have disbanded and gone their ways, many of the musicians in the Yardbirds aren't even playing professionally now. The Americans still are interested in the phenomena. Yeah. Why?
I think it's because they're born to delve back into their heritage and find out. And that, you know, it's like Japan. They've started asking who was on what record, and they just, obviously, when they're at a certain age, certain sounds catch their ear. And like I was impressed with Scotty Moore. I mean, I just had to know who he was and where he lived and, you know, who took over from him, James Byrne. Okay, so now I know all about James Byrne, and so it goes on. Mm. You just get fanatical about these people.
You think that you were interested in American musicians as much as perhaps Americans are interested in British musicians?
Absolutely. For the same reason.
Well, coming back from the American tour in 1966, you released Over Under Sideways Down. Mm. Was that particularly good for you, that song?
No, I if you listen to that record, there's a kind of Eddie Cochran bass slapping sound in it, which was a bit of 50s rock creeping back in. Even then, it was like my attempt at revival of that kind of, you know, because everybody was playing smooth and very Motowny type bass, but without that aggression.
Mm.
So that record had that, but I didn't really like it. It was too much of a jumble, and the words didn't. The melody was non-existent. I started losing interest in. I lost faith in their what's the word? Judgment on what should be put out as a pop record. We should have stayed away instead of kind of come out and deliver on cue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about the songwriting then? Did you play a big part in the songwriting?
Well, this is another thing. It's a bit naughty to say it, but I wasn't very good at writing lyrics. I still couldn't write two lyrics that made sense. And the rest of the lads in the band realised that publishing was a hot tip, and to write a silly melody and a few lyrics, you could tie up the whole business. Doesn't matter how many great guitar solos you do, you don't get the... And I just didn't like the idea that I was being rode out of that side of it. And that's really what starts a lot of arguments going. Somebody puts a nice bit of icing on the cake, which makes it the record sometimes, and then you're not entitled to the writing royalty on it.
Well, more group changes took place after that album. Paul Samuel Smith left. Yeah. Why was that?
He always wanted to be Phil Spector. He used to wear the same hat, and he was very impressed with Phil Spector's work with the Righteous Brothers. And it's quite understandable that you'd want to try and find out how Phil Spector did that great sound. And aside from that, he wanted to produce folk music, I believe. People like, he was into Bob Dylan really quite heavily. And I think he found a way of staying in the music business without touring, which is a very good way to...
Mm.
Like, you can meet hundreds of people, hear all their music, without going outside a single door, you know. Mm.
Again, modern musicians. Now, history's been written as far as touring's concerned, but when the Yardbirds were together, they were making history, learning to get on buses and planes and be in different cities every night. Nowadays, if a group goes on tour, they know exactly what's ahead of them.
Yes, that's right. Well, it was just a great pioneer feeling. You thought, hey, where are we going tonight? Are we going to get there even? You know, I mean, where's the gig? I mean, it was all part of the crazy world that it was then, and it ran parallel in the lunacy.
Well, it'd been about a year by that point, by the point that Paul had left. Mm. You'd been in the band a year, so you'd obviously got to know Keith Relf, Jim McCarty, the other members of the group. How did you get on? Did you socialise outside of the group?
Well, I was pretty unbalanced then, and very fiery-tempered, and they weren't. They were very cynical and calm and collected. And I was just... They kept me in line a lot of the time. I'd throw the most dreadful, moody and swear, and they'd laugh at me. And I had no choice but to just swallow. But it was Giorgio that upset me, because I started sussing out what was going on management-wise and all that. And I alerted the rest of them, and they were prepared to sit back and take it because they liked the way that things were going. And I didn't like the way things were going.
Well, another major change that went on, Paul left and Jimmy Page came in. Now, he'd been in the background for a while anyway. I mean, he'd been approached, hadn't he?
Yes. Giorgio had approached him because he was the obvious choice. He was a wizard on the guitar. And they, for some reason, they had to have a guitarist. You know, I thought that was a strange thing because he could have had a guy playing a violin. I mean, why the guitar all the time? But that they were right in pushing
or
to get a good guitar.
Perhaps.
Yeah. But no, they wanted a wizard on the guitar. They had to have that. And Jim was the obvious choice. And they were horrified when he turned it down. They were so sure. It's like the football teams. If you get a wizard of 16 and turning around and saying, no, thank you, I'm not interested. They couldn't handle it. Couldn't handle it.
And, but he did eventually.
Eventually, Simon Napier-Bell took over management. And for some reason, Jim gave in to him where he wouldn't give in to Giorgio. So we sat in an Indian restaurant somewhere in London, and I actually witnessed Jimmy cracking up and saying, yes, I will join. And I went, oh, right. Because he was one of a real close friend at that time.
Did you feel insecure or that perhaps what had been your little post, if you like, as the lead guitarist was threatened in any way?
Not at all. I was delighted that he joined because we used to get on so well. I mean, the telepathy was there and humour. I mean, just a good buddy. And I thought, well, even if we do fight over the guitar a bit, it's still going to be there's 99.9 of the time you're not playing anyway. You just get on well. Surely we can sort out that other fraction, you know. Mm. And we did. We got some nice double lead things going. Furious guitars going on. Mm. And that's where the psychedelic guitar style comes from. That manic dual guitar. We're all blowing away. Mm. And this is gorgeous, ghastly noise to some, you know.
Happenings 10 years ago was a song that you released at that time, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't really too up on all this sort of drug stuff. I mean, I never taken drugs, ever. Nothing that would hallucinate. And I think Keith did. I think these lyrics showed that he did that. But I couldn't understand a lot of what he was driving at with his lyrics. He's a very inward person. And I just wanted a good excuse to have a charge about on stage and play the way I could play. I didn't care what the songs were about.
Didn't you think you were being unfashionable? Because everyone seemed to take drugs in those days. All the songs and singles were... I mean, even the Hollies, who were very straight, had singles out that were related to drug taking.
I know. But drugs frightened me because I'd never seen a good advertisement for them. You know, everybody I looked at looked idiots, and they're all sort of... That whole 60s Chelsea thing made me sick. I couldn't stand it. I used to, you know, Mick Green, who's a guitarist with Freddie Starr, I mean, he and I used to think a lot the same. And when I hear his point of view on drugs, I just could never take them on the strength of that alone.
Well, you were ill at one point after Happenings 10 years ago, and that point Jimmy Page took over on lead guitar.
That's right, and it was all a bit funny because I didn't know if he was secretly delighted that I'd gone or whether he didn't want the rather sort of heavy duty responsibility of trying to fill my shoes at that time. But they went to Australia, and I'm afraid Jim got a bad time from the Aussie fans because the tour had been long awaited, and they were fortunately, well, at that time I was being plugged a lot, more than probably Keith was. And when they old Jimmy turned up and I wasn't there, it was pretty bad, so it must have had a bad effect on him. His first tour, it's him on lead guitar, sort of thing.
That seemed to be the height of the Yardbirds' fame about that time, and then it started to wane, didn't it?
I think it was because Samuel Smith wasn't there, and although he was a bit aloof from rock and roll, he still had some pretty cute ideas. And without him, and with Keith going down the pan with alcohol, which he was, and Jim not really knowing what the hell was going on, he had to pick up a few loose ends, and it wasn't working. Management was a bit crumbly then. It's just add all the things together and you've got disaster.
From what you're saying, it seems like you were the casualty of what went on for a lot of groups in those days, and yet people like The Who and The Rolling Stones have survived it through the years, although both of those groups respectively have lost musicians. Keith Moon, Brian Jones.
You have to have a nucleus. A good solid song to keep a band together, I think, and you've got to enjoy, everybody's got to like playing it, I think, and it's got to be successful. It's no use having a load of great songs and nobody likes them. Those things, if you've got those factors there, I think you're halfway there to keeping a band together.
You said that Jimmy went off with the Yardbirds and he was the lead man for the Australian tour and had a bit of a hard time. Were you out of the group completely at that point?
I think so. I mean, when I knew they were going to Australia and they finished off the tail end of an American tour, the Dick Clark tour, which I mentioned earlier. And I desperately wanted to see Jim to say, I'm sorry about lumbering you like this. And then I found out he was quite happy, you know. Then he wasn't too happy when he came back from Australia. The reports were bad. And then they started playing gigs in England, and I went along to see him, and it was pretty bad. They didn't even have the fire playing the old early sort of I'm a Man type records. And,
of course, they also changed the production on their albums as well. They released Ten Influences. Yeah. Let's go back a bit. Little Games.
Little Games and Goodnight, Sweet Josephine, which were written by Paul Jones, I think. And they were desperately trying to get back to do the same thing that For Your Love did, which was put them back in the charts. Mm. And they were the wrong records.
Different production, too.
So Mickey that sealed Mills. Their fate, really.
Mm.
Yes.
The production was different too, wasn't it? I mean, Mickey Most had come in, background of very poppy songs.
Oh, yes. Whatever would have been remaining in terms of hard blues was nailed straight on the head by Mickey. He didn't want to hear about all that. He wanted to put the Yardbirds into the Mickey Most slot. And I'm afraid he didn't have a clue as to what damage he was doing at that time.
It seems ironic, looking back now, that for the Eric Clapton left for what could be similar reasons to the reason why you left eventually, and that was that they were going too poppy.
Yeah.
You wanted to stay with the blues, by the sound of it.
Yeah, I think I'd like to stay, but it was just those tours. I don't know what it was. From 1 year, 66, 60, well, when was it? 65 to mid-66, I was over the moon with touring and I was meeting new people and having a great time, and all of a sudden I didn't want to. Mm. And the thought of a tour, and I'd see these big, thick wads of paper, you know, January, February, March, Bowling Green, Kentucky, California. Oh, Christ, not there again, you know. It's like a ghastly treadmill that I couldn't face.
And yet, you've continued touring, though, over the years. I mean, when you left Yardbirds, yeah, you didn't go into obscurity.
It's on my turn, see, it's on my turn.
Let's talk about some of the things that you did while you were with the Yardbirds. You Shook Me, which is a song you wrote.
No, I nicked it.
But you nicked it from who?
Muddy Waters.
And yet that was stolen by the Led Zeppelin, wasn't it?
Well, this is where Led Zeppelin take over. Page then comes round and starts catching up with what I'm doing with Rod Stewart and Ronnie Wood and Mickey Waller. And I don't care what anybody says, that was one of the best bands ever. You know, on a good night, they were just...
Which band was that? That was...
Jeff Beck, first band, right for after the Yardbirds with Rod.
Right.
There was a lot of cock-ups in the beginning with musicians getting the sack because they weren't right and all that. Mm. We got loads of bad press because the press seemed to have this high regard for bands that, you know, kept guys on from the word go.
Yeah.
You couldn't sack anybody, you know. I said, what are you talking about? Your great favourite, Buddy Rich, who you keep waxing about all the time, sacks trombonist halfway through the set, you know. Mm-hmm. They don't come down on him. Oh, well, that's jazz. Mm. You owe it to these young boys to keep them in your band. I had somebody's mother on the phone. Some drummer's mother was belly aching about. He'd given him a raw deal, and I mean, he just collapsed and couldn't play properly on stage.
By the time you left the Yardbirds and you decided you were going to go out in the world and do whatever you felt best, there were many more musicians around and vocalists, Bobby Tench, Max Middleton. Yeah. You mentioned Ronnie Wood, Rod Stewart, all in their early 20s at that point, weren't they?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you must have felt quite pleased that you had on offer a lot of people that you could work with, a lot more freedom perhaps than the confinement of being in the Yardbirds.
I think a lot of the reason I was able to pick out these players was because they were probably impressed with my flexibility and not, you know, like Pete Townsend had to have the power chords and that. So you knew what you were going to be doing if you joined The Who, for example.
Mm.
But you never knew with me what was going to be. And I didn't know either. Mm-hmm. I didn't tell anybody.
Do you think that's one reason why you've continued to keep that popularity? Because you've kept ahead of your critics in a way. They don't know what you're going to do next.
No, and I think that's the way to do it.
Mm. So out of the Yardbirds, you didn't do much immediately, did you?
No, I had about 6 months off to get fit again. I was pretty sick and I had meningitis and things.
Mm.
And I just thought that was it. I was finished. But gradually I came around and picked the guitar up again and got bored. And I started looking for singers. You know, which was the prerequisite. You had to have a front man, a singer. And I was lucky to get the first guy that I wanted, you know, which was Rod. And
Rod had been in Steam Packet.
Yeah. Julie Driscoll and Brian Auger Trinity. Not Brian. It was part of the Steam Packet.
Mm.
And John Baldry. But prior to that, he was in Jimmy Powell and the Five Dimensions, which you probably won't want to remember. But the guy had an unreal voice. It was furry and husky and. Mm. Just exactly what I wanted to play behind.
Mm.
And I asked him what he was doing. He said nothing. Gave him my number and he said, if you wouldn't mind the expression, he said, you're full of shit, you're not going to ring me. I rang him the next day and he said, I couldn't believe it last night that you wanted me in the band. Nobody wants me. I said, shut up, you old tart, let's go. We had a rehearsal and it was electric right from the minute we started.
Well, of course, that was the formation of one of the best bands around at the time, wasn't it?
And we nicked the drummer from Brian Auger, I think, was Mickey Waller, who was heavily Motown influenced, who was just right for what I wanted. He had the Motown feel, but for an experimental blues band, which is just great, you know.
Mm.
And we had trouble finding bass, and then Ronnie came along.
Mm.
We had him off rhythm guitar. He was a rhythm guitarist.
Mm. How did that band go? You toured and recorded?
Well, it was pretty tough going then, because people were dialed in strongly to Manfred Mann, and it was pretty closed. You know, anything outside and didn't have a record, you were limited to club work, really.
Mm.
So we'd be going playing these shitty little dives in north of England.
Mm.
But still converting. Everybody every night was coming home going, oh, yeah, that was good.
How did you feel? Because for people like Stuart, they played in Steampack. It was a good apprenticeship for him. After that, the Faces came along and then his own solo career.
Mm.
And off he went into stardom. That's right. And there you were. I mean, you'd already had
years of experience
behind you.
Yeah.
But you didn't mind that. I mean, for you...
It bugged me in a way because he slid through without any effort whatsoever. And I felt that the only thing I'm bitter about Stuart is that he never, in any of his write-ups or interviews, has ever given me credit for putting him on the map, so to speak, which is really true, taking him to America. I mean, everybody knew Rod DeMod in England, and he's had several cracks at the whip, you know. And people used to go, oh, yeah, that's Soppy Ponce with the Monsieur Hulot's holiday Macintosh and the back-combed hair. And when I went to America, they were even saying, who's that Ponce you've got singing, you know. It was terrible. I have to make cover up and say, well, no matter what he looks like, listen. And then gradually they start to come around. Typical Yank, you know, what's that crap? Don't want it. You know, let's have another look. And we hit Chicago and that did it, mate. That did it. You know, when he started singing, You Shook Me. I mean, the whole place just went banana.
Mm.
So towards the end of that band, skipping all the bits and pieces, Jimmy Page started to get into it and started, he actually came out to Philadelphia. There's some place, the Electric Factory or some jive place we went, and there was Jim in the front row for about 6 nights of that tour, and then he disappeared. I thought, well, I hope he had a good time. It's a bit quiet. The next thing you know is the Zeppelin's coming along, and guess what's on their first album, You Shook Me, followed by a few little other things. But
why do you think Led Zeppelin made it as that kind of power group?
They did some work.
As opposed to your band, which had just as good people in it, though.
I know, but I mean,
Rod Stewart's vocal singing is different to Robert Plant's, admittedly, absolutely. But he's just as solid. He knows the songs, and he's got the soul in his voice.
Yeah. I think it was an astute piece of planning from Jimmy's point of view, getting Robert, who looked fantastic, you know, I mean, the golden locks and all that. He was the thing, you know, I mean, he was obviously the thing to come, whereas Stewart looked a little bit shaky, you know.
Mm.
Oh, sorry, I've got a little bit...
We're talking about the tour and how Jimmy had gone...
That's right. I mean, where I would say, oh, sod this, I've had enough of this. We've done 3 months, let's call it a day and see what the next tour does for us. See if we can make a good record. The thing that really came to a head was the gigs were going like wildfire with the Stuart band, the first Stuart band. And Mickey Waller was flailing a bit. He just didn't have the physical power, bless his heart. I mean, he was right there in spirit and soul, but he just didn't have the power... So we needed a powerful drummer, and that started the conflicts in the band between the members. We used to get on pretty well, Rod and I. And then when this drummer, I won't say who it is because it's unfair to him, but there was a lot of dissatisfaction in the band. And what with one thing or another, we looked at the date sheet, and lo and behold, there's Woodstock. And we didn't know how big it was going to be, but it looked too big to make a mess of it and have a row on stages up hitting each other, which is what was going to happen. So I cut off that gig. Talk about stupid. I mean, on reflection, I'm glad we didn't do it because a lot of bands fizzled out after that movie came out.
Mm. But you could have stood up to that.
I could have, but I just didn't want something bad to happen on a huge scale. And I really chickened out.
Mm.
And Rod was really annoyed because he wanted to do it. And my way of getting my spite back was to say, right, you can do it. I'm not going to be there. And that was the last. I think we've still got the date sheet, and I think the dates go right up to the day before Woodstock, and then that was the end of the band.
Mm. Then you came back to England and started again. Although you released some singles yourself, though, didn't you?
Yeah, in between, Mickey Most helped to project me on another. Wait a minute, we've missed a bit out somewhere. Hi-Ho Silver Lining.
Yes, that's what I was trying to get us into.
Hi-Ho Silver Lining was before Stuart.
Before Stuart. That was a sort of solo passage before you had Hey Good,
right.
Wasn't it?
That's right.
Well, let's do that and then jump ahead to the other side of Stuart. So after the Yardbirds, a period of silence, but you released some singles, Hi-Ho Silver Lining, which was very big in this country as a single, wasn't
it? That's right, but nothing in America for some reason. It's still not known there now, even.
Hmm.
Mickey really chose a winner there. I mean, it's an evergreen now, but I hated it. I still don't like it, really.
Mm.
And after that, the problem came, what's going to be the next follow-up to that? And I kept plugging Rod all the time because he was my singer in the band.
Mm.
He said, you're the man under contract and you're the man that's going to go on record. Sod Rod Stewart, you know, and I bet he's kicking himself now.
I shouldn't think so.
No.
So after you came out of Woodstock,
yeah.
jumping ahead again yeah. now, back to England, basically the end of the Rod Stewart, Ronnie Wood aspect yeah, of the Jeff Beck group. What yeah. happened then?
Well, they decided they couldn't handle my irrational moves and cancellations of tours and being stupid, and which was quite understandable, really. Nobody could stand the way I was then. I couldn't stand myself.
Mm.
And it wasn't any surprise when I learned that they'd sort of knocked it on the head with me. But I wanted to change anyway, but I just didn't have anybody in mind. I didn't like that, jumping off one thing and not having something else ready. And then I heard that he'd joined the Faces, and I thought, oh, that's it. That's it. Got to start another band.
Small Faces were a superb band. And, of course, the Faces are a different sort of group,
really. Yeah, I've seen a lot of Faces fans when Rod took over because they thought, oh, what's he doing in that band? You know, where's Stevie Marriott?
Mm.
And I was one. I used to like Steve Marriott. And, and it was too easy. He just sailed straight out of my band into a ready-made band, got rid of Steve Marriott, boom. Did, what was it, Lyceum in London. I went up to see it, and it was diabolical. Mm. I mean, absolutely dreadful. It was the worst noise I've ever heard. And I thought, well, that's the end of them. That's sealed their fate. Next thing you know is John Peel loves them. Boom, 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 all over the bloody place on the radio. Maggie May, wallop, that's the end of it.
What happened to you then?
Well, the beginning of it.
Yeah, what happened to you at that time? You were starting to form another group?
Well, there's a little bit we've skipped, which was the Rod Stewart, Tim Bogert and Carmine Appice band, which was a super sort of powerful band, which was going to be the Led Zeppelin type band. But Stewart got frightened that we'd be living in America with these two guys. And I said, no way, you know, I would never live in America. He said, yeah, come on, why don't you just get over there? I love England, blah, blah, blah. And he also thought that there would be too much slick musicianship and that we'd be blowing each other off the stage and Rod was wandering around like a, you know what. So we couldn't handle it.
How did you feel about Appice? Because, I mean, from an American band that were doing similar kinds of things to the Yardbirds at the same time, weren't they?
That's really strange because we used to respect Vanilla Fudge and for doing a kind of American Yardbird type thing. And we saw them at the speakeasy and they were just sensational. I would never forget it. I mean, there were a lot of arrangements that were copied from the Yardbirds, but they were so fine, you know, that once I heard them, I thought, wow, one day when that guy's on the street, we're going to get together. And lo and behold, I did a Coke commercial for Carmine. I think Carmine wanted to use me instead of his own guitarist because he used to like the Yardbirds. And from that Coke commercial came the BBA idea.
And that lasted for how long?
BBA? Not long. I can't remember. Over a year, was it?
18 months. Not much more.
No, that was... I mean, there again, you had a Yardbird sort of fieriness. And like the bass player was gaga. And he was really brilliant bass player. But you got all the crankiness with it. The character. Carmine was the... emulsifier. He used to keep us all smooth all the time. Used to break out into rages and things.
He's one of the most highly respected drummers, isn't
Carmine? He? Well, he's the greatest. I mean, he's just... He's the... I suppose what rock... He is to rock drumming what somebody like... what's his name? Buddy Rich is to the big bands. I mean, people like Louis Belson. I mean, he revolutionised rock by using double bass drums. In a certain way.
You've done something by aligning yourself with American musicians that nobody had done before, British-wise, had they? Except maybe John Mayall.
Yeah, he used to use some American players, horn players and things, but I used to look for that grittiness in the drums that no English drummer had. There was one or two guys, like Bobby Elliott from the Hollies, who was pretty good, but they all had that kind of like Liverpudlian annoying sort of
slow,
chunk of
frustrating.
And when you heard Carmine, that was it, mate. That was the end of it. It was like a sort of air raid, you know, bah, wallop. And I thought, well, that's a bit of me, I'll have that.
I'll do.
And when you play with a guy, the guitar just plays itself, you know, the power is there and you just play.
Play along with it. You've got so many openings where you can.
That's right.
Notes.
He was an ideal trio drummer because of the two bass drums. And Tim was a fairly busy but very solid bass player.
So that was the next thing you did after Rod Stewart, was it? BBA.
Yeah, without Rod. Right,
right,
Rod
exactly.
Didn't. So then we had to come to terms with the fact that we didn't have a singer. And we had sort of two-thirds of the fudge, or half the Vanilla Fudge vocal, which, okay, it wasn't that good, but it had the makings of something. If we, all we needed was to get the right material, and I could have learned to sing the third-part harmony. We'd have had close three-part harmony with the power drums and a wild bass and a wild guitar. It had to be good.
Mm.
Never got there.
Mm.
Never got there.
Mm.
Shame.
Did you live in America while that band was going?
No, we just toured there, and I made every effort to get away from America, because I didn't want to absorb their lifestyle and get too messed up with it. I wanted to stay English.
Mm. Yeah. Which year does that bring us up to now?
73,
is it? 72?
It's after the Bobby Tench Band.
73, that is.
It's the end of BBA.
You've missed it,
the Cozy Band.
Yes, Cozy, yes. Tench, Max, right. Middleton.
That was after Stuart, was it?
That,
before
yeah.
BBA.
Well, it tried BBA, and it didn't happen, did it?
Oh, I
because
see,
of the
yeah.
car crash.
Mm. Yeah. That's right, the car crash gnawed up the Stuart Band,
that's
really.
That's right, yeah.
And he did, Stuart would probably have said yes to it, but he heard that I was like, car crash, and he thought, oh, no
too
way.
Much
it's all.
Hassle.
Yeah. That's right.
So you had a little go at BBA, and then the Max Middleton, Cozy, Bobby
No,
Trench.
No.
Didn't you sort of have half an attempt, though, to get BBA together before Cozy?
Oh, God.
She came along. I thought you sort of tried to do it, and then they went back and formed Cactus.
And Stevie Wonder.
Yeah, but I mean...
That's right. I was with Max and Purdy, and it was that session we did with Stevie Wonder, with the Superstition Business, that BBA were lurking outside the studio, literally, waiting for me to come out and go...
Grab hold of
yeah.
him as he'd been...
And Cozy was going bananas because he thought, hello, what's Carmine hanging about for? You know, it was all too much for me then.
Yeah.
And I wanted to play with Stevie anyway. Mm. I wanted to go, bye, boys.
Mm.
Where's your drummer, Stevie? Get a bass player, let's go.
Yeah.
But it could have happened, but it just didn't.
How was it playing? I mean, you played with some of the very strong British players with... Bobby Tench and
yeah,
people like that.
Oh, we auditioned hundreds of singers trying to get somebody who was just right.
Mm.
And it was very depressing.
Mm.
I remember just being so depressed. We'd hear these guys and they were so hopeful, and you'd have to say, oh, sorry, mate, you know, just, you know.
Mm.
And they go, oh, wow. And that, I just, that part of it I didn't want. And I the only alternative was not to audition them with them knowing they were being auditioned, just go along and see them.
Mm.
And then when you see the guy, hey, come here, you. Forget your band, that's it.
Well, you'd had that done to you so many times that you felt you.
But it meant getting in a bus or bloody car and going up north, and I didn't want all that.
Mm.
I'm lazy, really.
That brings us up to where? That's so the third Jeff Beck group, I suppose.
Yeah, so that's it. After the Stevie Wonder Superstition business, we then had BBA together doing Superstition, because that Stevie wrote that song. And it was great, you know, we started going nuts on it. Went to Germany, had a few gigs there, and then America, and started making a lot of noise in America. Then there was Grand Funk Railroad and not Blue Tier, there was a lot of really awful, loud bands about, and we thought, hey, we're going to get snarled up in this lot.
Mm.
We didn't like being associated with them, you know, because we were a lot different. And then we tried to cut a really good album, which impressed the record company, and they really weren't... There was no way we could get the power on record.
Mm.
Nobody knew how to record us properly. We tried the Rolling Stones producer, and that didn't work.
Led Zeppelin managed it, though, hadn't they?
They did, but all the time, see, Jim was in the studio as a session man. He picked up all these tips of how to get a big fat drum sound and all that, and I never really got into it.
Mm.
I just thought, oh, well, there's all these knobs and switches. You must be able to get that sound.
Mm, mm. And then you changed completely after that, didn't you? You changed your direction.
Yeah, I just washed my hands with the whole thing, and I went a bit sort of snobby, you know, and tried to dazzle people with the footwork. And